I'm Rick Ganley. This is an NHPR News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Hospice began in the 1970s as a nonprofit grassroots movement that sought a more humane, less medicalized way of dying, one focused on physical and emotional comfort, not cure. But a recent Washington Post report on hospice care has set off a huge debate about how it's provided today. The Post says change began in the 1980s when Medicare began covering hospice and more private companies got involved. That led to growing numbers of patients entering hospice, even, according to the Post, those who didn't need it. Frail and elderly, yes, but with perhaps many more years left to live. While the report was praised for describing important shifts in hospice and for raising key questions, many involved in this sector took issue with its conclusion that hospice firms are draining billions from Medicare. They argued the research shows otherwise, and just as important, that hospice definitively improves the end of life for patients and their families. Today in The Exchange, rethinking end-of-life care, and we begin with the Washington Post reporter who helped work on this article. He co-wrote the article I described. Reporter Peter Woriski joins us from Washington. And Peter, thank you very much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Well, right up front, Peter, if you could, just give us your best layperson description of what hospice is. A lot of folks probably would just describe it as a place you go to die, but it's a lot more than that.
Well, it's what most people don't realize is that it's not any specific place beyond your home. In the vast majority of instances, hospice is usually offered as a service that allows people to die at their home. For the most part, in order to get it and have Medicare pay for it, you have to have a doctor, and sometimes two doctors, say you're not going to live beyond 6 months, or you're not likely to live beyond 6 months, and Medicare pays for it.
And then a whole team of providers jumps in and really providing a large measure of physical and emotional comfort for the patients and their families. Just describe a little bit, Peter, about what happens once you are certified for hospice.
Well, if you're going to be at your home, they send out a nurse and they may have some hospice aides. You get a social worker. I think you get a chaplain. There's a little bit of variety on what exactly the team would involve, but you get a group of people who are meant to focus on making sure they can be comfortable.
And I tried to summarize your article as best I could, Peter, and there was a lot there, of course, but what's the one thing that you really wanted readers to understand with this examination of hospice that you and your colleague did?
Well, one of the things that really stood out to us was that 60% of the money that Medicare spends on hospice goes for patients who are living longer than 6 months. The whole idea of hospice was that it was supposed to be for people who were actually dying. It became very clear to us that there are financial incentives to enroll people who aren't dying, because hospice doesn't spend that much money taking care of somebody who's maybe frail, but that isn't going to require a lot of attention.
So 60% of the money Medicare spends on hospice is for people who are living longer than the expected 6 months. That's sort of the hospice standard.
That's correct. And yeah. Some of them are living for years. And the other thing that we noticed is that there's been a large jump in the number of people who are discharged from hospice alive, which is a success story, no doubt, for those people, but it's suggest that maybe hospice isn't being used for the right people all of the time.
As you know, Peter, there's been a lot of praise for your article and a lot of pushback. And here's one response from Forbes magazine that I did want to ask you about. I'd love to hear what you think. Forbes says, the Post article misses a bigger question. Why are growing numbers of people willing to enroll in hospice long before they are dying? Part of the reason may be because they thrive on the care hospice provides, care they can rarely get anywhere else in our medical system. What do you think, Peter?
There are a few people who will say there is something called the hospice effect. And by that, they mean that people are able to live longer, so that people who might have had a six-month prognosis got in, might have a year or two with this one again. I don't see very much evidence for that at all. I see much more often the either doctors or nurse practitioners making such under pressure for sales goals.
And Peter, I think we're losing you on the phone line here, so I'm going to ask you just one more question, if I could, please. What more would you look at if you were to do more reporting on this article? What angles still need to be explored?
Oh, we have a lot of angles. I mean, one of the big ones I think other people have noted before is that to be a hospice agency, most health agencies are inspected on a yearly or 18-month basis, and I think the current Medicare rules say that you can be a hospice and get inspected every 6 years. It leaves open the possibility, I think, for perhaps some bad care.
Well, Peter, thank you very much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Sure, thank you.
Peter Wariski, again, Washington Post reporter, who co-wrote the article on hospice that started a big debate about how hospice has evolved from its roots in the 70s to how it's carried out today. And this hour on The Exchange, that's what we're going to be talking about, current conversations around end-of-life care. We'll look at what we've learned from several decades of hospice and also a newer focus on what's called palliative care. Let's hear from you. Your personal experiences with this issue are welcome. Your questions about what works and what doesn't. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. We have two guests for the hour who have worked for a long time in this field. Dr. Patrick Clary is with me in studio, medical director of Rockingham VNA's Hospice, medical director of Riverside Rest Home in Dover, and director of palliative care at Exeter Hospital. And Dr. Clary, thank you for coming in. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Also with us from Boston is Dr. John Lochnane. He's Senior Vice President for Medical Care at Commonwealth Care Alliance. He also runs its end-of-life program. And Dr. Lochnane, thank you also for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, and Dr. Lochnane, you first, your take on this debate that the Post raised that, you know, perhaps hospice has become a moneymaker, that patients are being recruited for it, even if they don't need it. They live way beyond the 6 months that is expected.
So a few quick comments. First, that hospice has many wonderful benefits that it gives to patients. So, you know, as always, we never want to paint things in a black and white brush. But I think those of us who are involved in the industry have recognized this for some time. Hospice came into being as a Medicare benefit as part of a tax bill. And in fact, a six-month magic number was nothing ever set in science. And in fact, a lot of us have really started to think about what are alternative measures. And again, our own program here, our patients can choose Medicare hospice, but we've actually unbundled and uncoupled hospice where patients don't no longer need to choose hospice but can get end-of-life care, as we call palliative. That actually has a number of benefits, including one is we no longer pay the per diem. And to understand the hospice benefit, hospices are paid a daily rate. So obviously, they need to have their census up with daily rates to have their income stream. We've changed that more to a fee-for-service component. And at the same time, we've not asked patients to make clear choices about whether they want a hospice or aggressive care. We've simply provided them what we call normative primary care. We've said that if you kind of envision a seesaw, all of us during our lifetime can be on that seesaw where perhaps aggressive care is the predominant model. But then as we get older and aggressive care actually is doing more harm than good, it's more palliative in nature. We allow the seesaw to find its own balance without any specific your conversations about we're stopping aggressive care.
So a couple definitions. Sorry to interrupt you there, Dr. Lochnane, but a couple definitions. So hospice versus palliative versus normative primary care. We can get into the financing later, and we should, but just describe what these mean for the patient, for the human being.
Hospice traditionally has been a way to change a Medicare benefit that moves your care from the inpatient environment, where I work primarily as a hospitalist, to the outpatient environment and provides you with a set of services, including durable medical equipment, RN and LPN involvement in your care 24/7 a day, home health aides, social work, bereavement services, and clergy. Palliative care is not a benefit. It is an overall approach to patients' care, which focuses on quality of life, symptom control, and not cure at that point. We use normative primary care to basically say that in a lot of ways, medicines become too subspecialized, and what you see towards the end of life is patients' care is not dictated by their wishes, their families, or their primary care providers, but usually by the culture of the medical care system that they're involved with. Most of this came out of Dartmouth Health Atlas. So we want to back and move primary care back into normative, saying being your primary care provider is taking care of you at all facets of your life, including end of life.
Sure. At end of life, when your health gets complicated, you're often seeing, you know, several different doctors who are focusing on their own little silo, but not you as a whole person. That seems to be what you're saying, Dr. Yeah. Lochner. Is that right?
That's correct.
I want to get you into this too, Dr. Cleary. And since this report came out, some doctors in the field of end of life care have said they feel that not enough people access hospice care, unlike what the Post found, that perhaps too many people. What do you see in terms of enough people or too many people going into hospice at this point?
Well, I certainly don't see too many people going into hospice. What I see are folks coming into hospice too late. Half of all of our patients in hospice live 3 weeks or less.
Wow.
So the most common length of stay in hospice is 1 day. We have people dying in the ambulance on the way to a hospice house. I agree that hospice is not a place, but it's a way of caring for people, as Dr. Lochner describes. I disagree with the Post article in a lot of different areas. To say that, quote, a few people say there is a hospice effect is to disregard a large amount of medical research, which suggests there is indeed a hospice effect, that paying attention to people's comfort and their quality of life does tend to extend their lives.
They feel so much better.
They feel better, and
they're
trying to attain something they can actually attain. You can't live forever, but you can live today, and that seems to help. The average extension of life is about 30 days. We don't have a lot of live discharges. That's not my experience. People, we call it hospice graduation, when people survive unexpectedly and are discharged because they're improving. But the national figure is 16%.
I do apologize. We will finish up in just a minute with that thought. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. There's a winter storm warning in effect for southern and central regions of the state today and tonight. Winter weather advisory in effect for the North Country. Snow for today, mainly in the afternoon. It'll be heavy at times with highs low to mid-20s. Snow tapering off this evening. Total accumulations 4 to 8 inches south of the lakes region and toward the seacoast. 2 to 3 inches north of the mountains. Some clearing after midnight. Lows around 10 in the North Country. Teens lower 20s for the rest of the state. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Meridian Construction, a multifaceted contractor serving New Hampshire for over 20 years, pledging a strong partnership with every project they engage. In details at meridiannh.com. And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, primary care doctors and nurses who put you at the center of health. 13 locations statewide. Information at d-hdocs.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking once again at issues surrounding end-of-life care. We're talking specifically about hospice care and also what's known as palliative care. We invite you to join us with your questions and comments, personal experiences with this issue, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. Two doctors join us for the hour, both with long experience in this issue. Dr. John Lochner, he is with Commonwealth Care Alliance in Boston, and Dr. Patrick Cleary, he's a medical director at Rockingham's VNA Hospice and also serves at several other medical facilities. And Dr. Cleary, just before the break, you were talking about how what you see is not enough people accessing hospice care versus what the Post found, that perhaps too much are. And also you said that when many patients enter hospice, it's very late in the process. Give us a little bit more on that, please.
Well, when I started doing this in the 80s, we took care of about 10% of people who are dying. And now we're taking care of about half of people who are dying. And that's a huge improvement. The percent of people who graduate from hospice, a point criticized by the Post article, is actually nationally 16%. They used some statistics which proved to me that figures don't lie, but liars figure. They put together some California statistics and some Alabama statistics, which implied that discharges from hospice were as much as half of those who were admitted, which is not my experience at all, having worked at 10 or more hospices during my career, worked with 10 or more hospices during my career. It hasn't been that varied. The folks who come on late don't really get the benefit of hospice. We are running to catch up. They're in pain and need that dealt with, and the spiritual issues that are so important to them are not really addressed if we are running to catch up with pain. So that's a problem in itself. Something that the Post doesn't mention when it talks about the waste is that every hospice patient in most of the literature has a higher quality of life and saves the government thousands of dollars in terms of unwanted care. I want people to get the care they want, but when they don't want to be in an ICU, I don't want them in an ICU. And hospice is a much better way to care for them.
Well, and in the Union Leader, Dr. Ira Byock, well known in New England for his work in this field of end-of-life care, was quoted as saying, it's supposed to be end-of-life care, but it's turning out to be brink-of-death care. So again, Dr. Byock making the point, Dr. Lochnane, that when he sees folks entering hospice, it's too late in his opinion. I wonder what you see.
No, absolutely. So I think that we want 100% of people who are dying in this country to get compassionate, supportive care so that both they and their loved ones who remain feel like that, you know, in an acronym that this was a good death. But the issue really is people are coming late to hospice because the model is not correct anymore. Patients are not dying primarily of cancer. They're dying of diseases such as dementia, CHF, COPD that are entering into hospice, and those are harder to give 6 month or other prognoses.
What are some of those diseases that you mentioned? I'm just curious.
You know, basically hospices still take primarily care of cancer, but the rate of also congestive heart failure, dementia, failure to thrive, diseases that don't quite meet clear criteria. As a physician, it's hard to say when someone's going to die in 6 months from CHF. You can take a much broader guess than you can with cancer, where clearly you have survival rates and much more information. And this really harkens to this idea of, in the United States, we need a system that doesn't separate out living and dying. We don't need a black and white construct on a very, very gray human experience. We need to create payment systems that take the wonderful aspects of hospice and mix it in over time. Because the vast majority of patients go through a process of dying both physically and spiritually and psychologically. And hospice needs to support, palliative care end of life needs to support this as a holistic process, not what we see in the United States, which I agree with Dr. Byock, is it's aggressive care, and then here's hospice. What we need to do is match supportive palliative care so that at the end, hospice doesn't feel like a decision or endpoint. It feels like a natural extension of what's available.
All right, let's go to our listeners. A lot of people who want to jump in our conversation. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And let's go first to Jewel in Laconia. Hi, Jewel. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air. Thanks.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I experienced hospice care with my boyfriend last winter, and I can't say enough about the organization, the people who work for it, and what it does for end of life. He was diagnosed with inoperable pancreatic cancer, and while we were advised by the team at Dartmouth to pursue some aggressive chemo, he made the decision not to do that, and I think it was a very wise decision. And he had a very graceful, peaceful, purposeful end of his life, thanks to the care we got with hospice.
It must have been a hard decision to make, though, Jewel, huh? You know, the idea of quote-unquote giving up, you know?
Yes, it was very hard, and I have to say, he was able to stay at home the whole time, which was wonderful. We were together 100% of the time for the last 2 months of his life, thanks to hospice care, giving me the extra help I needed to make that happen. without them, I wouldn't have been able to do it, and it would have been a very different picture.
Can I ask you one more question, Jewel, if I could, please? And thank you so much for sharing your story. It's not easy. How old was your boyfriend?
69.
Yeah, okay. So, again.
69. He had no sign of any health problems at all, and it hit very suddenly. But, you know, he had 2 months from a little bit of a delayed diagnosis to the end of his life.
Well, Jewel, thank you for calling in and, again, sharing this. And, you know, it raises a question in my mind, Dr. Clary. Younger patients, he wasn't even quite 70, which in this day and age is, you know, considered relatively young. He's not in his mid-90s. How does hospice or palliative care approach people who, you know, might have another 10, 15, 20 years to go? Is it different?
Well, palliative care, from my point of view, is care that's directed at quality of life in difficult situations. Trying to figure out what the best care possible is for somebody who's relatively young is much the same process. And the prognosis, figuring out exactly what's going to happen, is somewhat more difficult because most often those folks who are younger only have one thing wrong with them and are otherwise healthy. So they can go on for a long time unexpectedly. But one of the reasons that I went into hospice care myself is that the insurance coverage is so much better for people who are seriously ill than it is actually for your everyday person who has a minor illness. I spend a whole lot less time arguing with insurance companies than I used to, which is certainly a benefit.
Because Medicare, again, covers it.
Well, Medicare doesn't cover the younger patients. Medicare does cover 85% of our patients. So 85% of our patients are either disabled and have Medicare because of that or are over 65.
I want to ask you also, that raises a question I had, Dr. Lochnane. What about the idea that hospice is growing in popularity because, as Dr. Clary says, it's covered and because it's giving patients what they desperately want, a humane, comprehensive, you know, patient-centered type of care focused on the whole person? What's the lesson there for the broader healthcare system?
I think the lesson is we need to rethink how we care for people as they become more chronically ill. In our system, we're in a unique place where we actually are an insurance company ourselves in the sense that we take dual-eligible patients and take their Medicare and Medicaid premiums and then spend it on the patient as we see fit to their needs. And I can tell you what we really have found, again, is that we don't wait until things are at the brink of end of life, that basically we support patients with their goals and their symptoms early on in the process. We can use personal care attendants at home and such. So what we really need to rethink the system is, and I think this is ultimately where both the human gain and financial gain is that we don't want patients to get into crises that are unsupported. And that having someone who has congestive heart failure, who has COPD or other things, getting 2 years of palliative care that goes along with the aggressive treatments until it's very clear to everyone that the aggressive treatments no longer are effective is our way to go. But to do that, we have to kind of uncouple this idea of simply aggressive, and then hospice. There was a very good study out of Harvard Medical School a few years ago by Jennifer Tamell and her team that clearly showed with small cell lung cancer that supportive palliative care during the entire process while the patient was getting aggressive care had significantly better outcomes for both patients and families. And I think we need to take that overall approach and just decouple discussion about end of life to say, let's do supportive care throughout. And in truth, I'd like to change hospice and palliative care to supportive care, because that's ultimately what we're doing.
So ultimately, Dr. Lochnane, blend this approach and apply it across the medical system? Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. This way you'll get patients. We never have, the system I now work in, I don't have to say you're dying, you have a choice between hospice and aggressive care. I can say, well, let's meet your needs today at this hour. And as a hospitalist who did this for a number of years, I was always put into this very uncomfortable situation where I, as the doctor, went in with the family there with our social work team saying, you know, quote unquote, there's nothing more we can do for you, although we didn't phrase it that way. Now think about hospice. What I say now is the world's open, but let's think about how you define quality of life, how you define symptom control, and we will not have you make any decisions about hospice and non-hospice. We're just going to take the person as they are where they're at.
Wow, that's a big shift, isn't it? And an easier conversation to have, maybe, Dr. Loughnane?
Much easier. And in our experience here with our patients, since we've started what we call these a la carte programs, patients have not opted to go into hospice because we can give them everything hospice does through our ability to purchase what's wonderful about hospice, but at the same time, allow them the thought process and a lot of times to say, I still have this option available.
Sure.
So it's leaving the as this woman showed, most people know. They know what they want, and once given the opportunity, they make the decision that's best for them. In our experience, most of the time is to get supportive, not aggressive care.
All right. Let's go back to our listeners. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Post a comment there if you'd like. Today in the Exchange, we're looking once again at new conversations about end-of-life care, hospice care, palliative care, what it all means. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. And Ingeborg is waiting in Hopkinton. Hi, Ingeborg. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning, and thank you for this opportunity to tell the story of our family member in her 90s who was being wonderfully cared for at one of the excellent nursing facilities we have here in Concord. And we are truly blessed by the sort of personalized care which our family members can receive. While she was there, I learned that she qualified for hospice, and I was a bit shocked, but said, of course, let's move ahead with this. And I cannot say enough about the hospice nurses, social workers, people who were in constant touch with us, giving this family member good care. I was a bit curious what this was costing. We were, of course, her resources were taking care of her own care at this nursing home. So I wondered what the fees on top of this might be. And I learned that Medicare was covering this. And I learned, and some of your listeners may be shocked, that it was over $10,000. And that is a month. When I learned this, I began to reevaluate my mother's situation, and she was getting good care. She was not in any pain. She had some special needs, as all of us will when they're almost 100 years old. But I asked them to please discontinue this private service of hospice because I felt that there were other people whose needs were greater who could use those resources provided by the government.
Wow, so you took your mother out of hospice.
I did.
I assumed it was your mother. I'm not sure if you said that.
And she did live several years after that and died peacefully with the nursing home staff around her here in Concord. And I'm forever grateful to this facility for the care which they gave her.
Well, Ingeborg, thank you very much. And Dr. Clare, what do you think about Ingeborg's experience?
Well, certainly not typical. The cost for routine hospice care for a nursing home patient is the same as routine hospice care for a patient at home. It's about $4,500 a month, not $10,000. And so I would assume she had some inpatient care mixed in there. It's very difficult to tell when a person is dying of a fatal illness like dementia, which is mentioned in the Post article as a place where there is some fraud and abuse. But that's also a place where I think hospice care does a lot of good and probably changes prognosis. The folks who we take care of who have dementia, we do see that they perk up, they have more company, they have another layer of care, whether they're in a nursing home or home. But if they perk up and stop declining for a period of time, then we have to discharge them. That's a hospice graduation. That's not a happy one from my point of view because Alzheimer's dementia is a terminal illness. I think that's one of the things that I would take issue with Dr. Loughnane. I think that not having the conversation about what's actually happening is a missed opportunity. I usually have those conversations with patients starting with what do you think is happening? And I've had many patients tell me, Doc, you dummy, I'm dying.
Mm, wow.
And in the context of a family meeting, that can really mobilize the family into understanding what exactly is happening and what their roles might be. So understanding that an illness is terminal is part of the process from my point of view.
You know, could we talk a little bit more about dementia? Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Loughnane.
In no way did I have these conversations all the time, so I want to be very clear that I think these conversations are crucial. and we know that just having these conversations is important for care. But the difference is when I have these conversations, I no doubt that I have them just as distinctly as anyone else, Dr. Clary. But what I'm not saying to the patient is, either or. So what I tend to say is, you are dying, and I use those terms. But let's talk about all the varied options we can offer you and this kind of new idea system that don't make you sign a paper saying, now I'm on hospice. So we have the discussions, and I guess I would say that we have more of these discussions because we've broken down the barrier of black and white decision making. So I just want to be very clear that we have the ability now to have this in a more humanistic conversation process, saying, here's where we're at, rather than those old doctor-focused, you're dying, what do we do next?
Here's an email from Amy in Concord, who raises some of the issues that our caller from Hopkinton raised. Amy says, I hope you will address what we have found with our elderly parent now in some dementia. It has nothing to do with finances and everything to do with tamping down the level of medical response to a body that is slowly failing. Hospice, Amy says, allows the family to formalize a palliative approach. There's that integration that we talked about. And then lastly, Amy says, we hear that many emergency rooms will not respect DNRs, do not resuscitate orders, but will respect a hospice enrollment. Dr. Lochnane, what do you think? Amy, great points.
Yeah, I think it's a great point, although I think ERs, it's for someone who works at Boston Medical Center all the time, both ERs and ICUs now are much more responsive to patients' wishes and ask at first. Massachusetts has a medical order of life-sustaining form, which is much clearer about those issues. I think it always is important to have an advocate with you to make sure that things are going the way you would want, and having a healthcare proxy named is very, very important. But in my practice, which has been in Washington State, Vermont, in Massachusetts, in general, I think hospitals have really had a significant change in how they view this and see their role is not just simply to intervene, but to focus on what the patient's wishes would be.
All right. More conversation, more emails. Amy, thank you for that one after a short break. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, more look at end-of-life care in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning. Coming up on the Diane Rehm Show, renewed debate over stand your ground laws. That's at 10 on NHPR. We have a winter storm warning in effect for southern and central regions of the state today and tonight. Winter weather advisory in effect in the North Country. Snow today, mainly in the afternoon. It'll be heavy at times, highs low to mid-20s. Snow tapering off this evening. Total accumulations 4 to 8 inches south of the lakes region and toward the seacoast, 2 to 3 inches north of the mountains. Some clearing after midnight. Lows around 10 in the North Country, teens lower 20s for the rest of the state. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from Heritage Plumbing, Heating, Cooling, Electric. Now offering electrical repair and service in addition to furnaces, boilers, and water heaters. Online at justcallheritage.com. In Concord Regional Visiting Nurse Association Hospice, providing specialized end-of-life care for terminally ill people and bereavement and grief support for their families. crvna.org. 940, this is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, the state's plans for settling a large mental health lawsuit. We'll talk about that tomorrow on The Exchange. This hour, issues surrounding hospice and end-of-life care, especially for elderly Granite Staters. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Our guests are Dr. John Lochnane, Senior Vice President for Medical Care at Commonwealth Care Alliance. He also runs its end-of-life program. And Dr. Patrick Clary, Medical Director at Rockingham's VNA Hospice and of Riverside Rest Home in Dover, also Director of Palliative Care at Exeter Hospital. And gentlemen, let's go right back to our listeners. Carl's calling from Dover. Hi, Carl. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for taking my call. I think it's a great program, and I'm glad to hear Dr. Clary's on the program. my question really has to do with the shift from sort of nonprofit to for-profit model in hospice care. And my wife worked for Seacoast Hospice for some years in the 90s and early 2000s. Her role was doing bereavement support, and Seacoast Hospice had a fabulous program for bereavement support with quite quite a lot of resources devoted to it. And really my question comes down to what is happening now with that aspect of hospice care, bereavement support, as the shift has moved toward the for-profit model.
Yeah, that's interesting. And we've touched on this, Dr. Clary, a little bit, for-profit versus nonprofit, but not a lot. Go ahead if you could address Carl's question.
Hi, Carl. I worked at Seacoast Hospice about the same time, and I do remember that we had a wonderful time taking care of people. This was presented as kind of a gloomy program as we ran up to it, but from my point of view, hospice has been the most gratifying work I've ever done and continues to be. The question of hospice, for-profit, non-profit, I think is kind of the wrong question. I think the competition is between hospice and no hospice. I think that the literature shows that for-profit hospices do pretty much as good a job as nonprofits. I'm prejudiced in favor of nonprofits. I work for a wonderful nonprofit, and I think that we do a great job, but I look around me and don't see that much difference, and the literature doesn't show that much difference. Bereavement support is required for a year after a hospice death and appears to be very helpful to people. All hospices are required to have 5% of the work done by volunteers. And in fact, when the profits discussed in the Post article were calculated, all that was left off. So that the article was inaccurate in that particular way. Hospice is not a profit center for nonprofits. In fact, we pretty consistently lose money. I don't really understand how for-profits work, but I can't condemn them because I think they do good work.
Carl, thanks a lot for the call. And Dr. Lochnain, a question that I'd like to return to that we touched on earlier. What about when a patient has some kind of dementia? You've said several times how important it is to have these conversations early about, you know, patient-centered care, palliative care, whether hospice is an option or not. How do you have those conversations when the patient, him or herself, really isn't capable of making those decisions?
And again, this is something that I work with all the time. I work in a practice with both physical and intellectual disability, and we face this issue quite a bit. And unfortunately, especially here in Massachusetts, and I'm not so sure about New Hampshire, and those patients, unfortunately, they need to have a guardian named. So one of the things, if I had to put any real advice for folks out in the audience, is if you do have a loved one who does have dementia or has other decline in cognitive ability, getting a healthcare proxy involved and named while the person is able and the medical terminology is competent to do so is so key. Because ultimately you want the family members and those who know the person best to make those decisions, and not simply the state guardian at that point. I will say this too, is that I think it's crucial to have very honest conversations about supportive and environmental care for folks with dementia. So often these are folks who come into the hospital without that conversation, as Dr. Cleary correctly said, that, you know, the only time they have it is when they're on the brink of death. And unfortunately, I've seen far too many patients with dementia with feeding tubes, with their hands tied and on sedatives such as Haldol in the hospital simply because no one had early conversations about how this person could be better supportive with an increased quality of life.
Wow. All right. Let's take another call. This is Paul in Somersworth. Hi, Paul. Thanks for being on The Exchange. Go ahead. You're on the air, please.
Yes, this is a question for both Dr. Clary and Dr. Lorraine, and that is that how do we change the culture of medicine? Back in 1998-99, the AMA recognized that doctors lacked an ability really to deal with end-of-life care appropriately in palliative care with their EPIC program, which was then called Education for Physicians in End-of-Life Care. One of the things that Dr. Lorraine was speaking about was trying to turn this into a normative type of approach, but how do we change a culture of medicine which considers death of a patient to be a failure, and so that we understand that taking care of people with palliative care, giving them comfort, is part of that norm.
Yeah, Paul, wow, great question. Thank you so much. And Dr. Lochnain, I'll turn to you first, but I want to
hear
both of you. Yeah.
Yeah, and I always tell the story. When my uncle died in Ireland, he was 89 years old, lived a long life, and I went to his his old farm, and his neighbor. I asked his neighbor what he died of, and he said he died of a Tuesday, which basically said that don't anyone know what he died. You need to know how he lived. The reality is, I think there's two parts to this answer, and one is clearly financial. Unfortunately, a lot of what happens with end of life care is if you're going to pay for aggressive oncological treatments, aggressive ICU care, which is relatively futile, then people will continue to do that. So the first thing is, I truly think we need to take a significant look about how we reimburse care that everyone agrees is probably not in the best interest of folks at time. And the second is there is no formal education process during medical school and residency about this. I don't know if Dr. Cleary had a different experience, but I never had any training at all on end-of-life care or how to have significant conversations.
Those
only emerged with on-a-job training. And I went to very good primary care residencies and medical schools, but it was only until I was faced with that, because, again, it's an issue that, unfortunately, has sort of been, as I keep on saying, and I don't mean to repeat myself, it's the unpleasant, uncomfortable conversation that somehow we need to bring back into to having a it being easier for everyone. And so, again, I don't know if Dr. Cleary had any insight into this.
Well, and real quick, Dr. Lochnane, though, so you had no training at all in this end-of-life approach or field of specialty. What do you think about today? Do you think young doctors entering medical school today
I think they have more, but I don't think it's sufficient. I think in an aging population with the level of chronic disease and who we take care of, probably learning end-of-life care and how to have good, honest conversations with patients should probably be first on the agenda for how we train our new physicians. And I know it's not first on the agenda.
Sure. Dr. Cleary, what do you think?
Well, I went to a medical school that did spend some time on end-of-life care, and it caught up with me when I became involved with hospice. But I think we need more formal education. We get 200 hours of OB education. Now, I'm a family doc by trade, and I never delivered a baby until I'd had many more hours of training at a subspecialty level. Half of people don't ever have any issue with obstetrics, and the half that do have doctors who have extensive additional training before they deliver babies. I think that we could use 100 hours of that. That would be a good thing. But, of course, there's a lot of bureaucracy ahead of that. I agree with Dr. Lochnane that there's a financial issue. If you pay people to do more, they do more. I think that an accountable care organization like, which is what I hear Dr. Lochnane really talking about, as proposed in the Affordable Care Act, is probably a direction that we should go and will go inevitably. The best places to get care have such organizations in place where it's not the money driving the care, it's what's wanted by the patient and what's needed in the situation. So changing the culture of medicine, Paul, I've been trying to change the culture of medicine since the 1980s, and I have to say that I've wasted my life in that sense. I do feel like the change in the hospice, the proportion of patients who are dying cared for by hospice is an advance, and we have a lot more conversations in the hallways of my hospitals and in the ICUs where I spend a great deal of my time, much to my surprise, trying to bail people out of bad situations, and the ICU doctors are our greatest advocates in many cases. They're eager to stop having people thrown into the river upstream from them, so that they don't have to pull them out of the river downstream, and it makes a lot of sense.
Well, go ahead, Dr. Lachlan.
The other thing too is I do think there is some bright part in the hospitalist movement. When you go into a hospital now, you're taken care of by a hospitalist. And I started my career as a primary care family practice doctor who then merged into being a hospitalist. But hospitalist as a growing professional entity who take care of patients in the hospital have really taken on good advanced goals of care. Discussions is one of the major aspects of being a good hospitalist.
A hospitalist is somebody who doesn't have an office and is
just
with the practice.
Just sees the inpatients.
There all the time in the hospital.
Yes, and I think that if I see a light at the end of this, it's the hospitalist movement understanding how important this is. And that's how I really came to palliative care. After seeing Mrs. Jones, who was 95 times in 6 months, I realized that even though she and I liked each other, this was not a good way to spend our time. Yeah. And then you start talking about alternatives. So again, a lot of times what happens in our medical care system today is that a patient, especially as they get more chronically ill than elderly, they do the yo-yo between their home, a hospital, a rehab, home for a day, back to the hospital. And the hospitalists in the community probably see these patients 10 times more than their primary care doctors do by the last, you know, few years of their life.
I'd love to get one more call in if we could. This is Tatiana in Westminster, Vermont. Hi, Tatiana. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to speak to you. You had talked about people with dementia, and my mother had dementia, and she was living at home and wasn't getting the care. She couldn't get the care she needed at home. I had to move her to assisted living. She rapidly declined and stopped eating and drinking and went on to hospice because she seemed like she was going to die in a few months. And she began to improve. And I had to move her to a nursing home so she could get more care. But she did improve, graduated from hospice, lived another 3 years.
Wow.
With quite a lot of improvement. And I think the difference was that she needed more care, you know, just daily care that a person with dementia needs. But I don't think she really needed nursing home care. And my concern is that Medicare does not pay for home health aides for people with dementia because it considers, you know, dementia not to be a real illness. And that's why some people like my mother need hospice care.
You know, Tatiana, I'm so glad you called. This is exactly the question that came up out of this Post article, Dr. Clary, that, you know, people gravitate to hospice because it gives folks what they need and Medicare covers it in a system where, you know, these other services are often not covered. So it's really filling a need there. Even if folks don't fit that 6 month, you know, you'll die in 6 month profile.
Well, people with Alzheimer's are terminally ill in the sense that we can't arrest their gradual decline, that we can't really do anything to cure their illness, and that they're going to die in some finite period of time. There is a place for prognosis there, though. The patient who stops being able to ambulate, stops being able to really communicate meaningfully is as close to death as somebody with end-stage lung cancer. So that patient is clearly appropriate for hospice. I agree that when more support is added, folks do get better, and that's okay, but most don't. And even if they do get better, they're still dying, and we do need better care than we have. Our Alzheimer's patients deserve better care than they usually get. But that's a big system change, and I don't see it coming.
Although I will I'll chime in here. You know, my organization, we have a senior care option plan, which is a dual-eligible Medicaid, Medicare, and that's what we do provide. So one of the things when I talk about the continuity and blending is we provide personal care attendance, not as part of hospice, just as part of everyday care structure, so that the patient can remain at home and can remain as do as well as they can. And ultimately, it's cheaper. It's cheaper to support people at home with this. So our hope is that sort of these small senior care option plans and other CMS demonstration models really move into the general community, because ultimately, if we have people with dementia, the family needs to be supported because the sleep patterns are disrupted. The patient needs to be supported. And as a whole, when I hear stories like this, my heart really feels for this, because ultimately this should be supported. We should take it off, again, getting hospice involved at the last part, but move the resources so that this person would have a personal care attendant at home for 8 hours a day. And I'm a bit more optimistic that with the Affordable Care Act and other things, that kind of common sense medicine will become more prevalent, more available for families.
So has it been hard to make this shift, Dr. Lochnane, you know, extending the wonderful benefits of hospice that we've heard so much about? Because right now, hospice is the only one that's really clearly spelled out, covered.
Right.
That's what's going on.
Yeah, I think this, you know, again, I live in a part of the reason I we developed this program is because we had the ability to do personal care attendance and have home visits with our NPs and such. But I think this idea is we're not alone. And I think that you're going to find that when you look at the cost of end-of-life care, which is a substantial part of the Medicare budget, that people are rethinking the wonderful aspects of hospices just need to be decoupled and put into a more financially viable process. The key to that is, though, of course, is that this needs to meet patients where they are and have those honest conversations. So I really do think in 15 years, this would be a very different conversation. We won't be talking about hospice or palliative care. We're talking about, you know, common sense end-of-life care that treats people the way they want to be treated at home, which is every survey says, and with support for the family so that they can determine how their passing can be and not the medical system.
Well, Dr. Lochnane, it's been great to have you. Thank you so much for giving us your time today.
Thank you.
Dr. John Lochnane, again, Senior Vice President for Medical Care at Commonwealth Care Alliance. He also runs its end-of-life program. And Dr. Clary, it was nice to see you. Thank you for coming in. We really appreciate it.
It was a privilege. Thank you.
Dr. Patrick Clary, Medical Director at Rockingham's VNA Hospice, also at Riverside Rest Home in Dover, and Director of Palliative Care at Exeter Hospital. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern, Nate Graby. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, moving ahead on mental health care. After years of legal wrangling, the state recently settled a major lawsuit over its treatment of Granite Staters with serious mental illness. Under the agreement, New Hampshire will spend an additional $30 million on services over the next 4 years. Now the state embarks on meeting the settlement's terms and finding the money. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show next at 10 on New Hampshire Public Radio. We have a winter storm warning in effect in southern and central regions of the state today and tonight. Winter weather advisory in effect in the North Country. Snow for today, mainly in the afternoon. It will be heavy at times, highs low to mid-20s. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Palace Theater in Manchester, presenting Divas Through the Decades, celebrating divas of our time, from Etta James to Madonna through March 1st. Tickets at palacetheater.org.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEBS Nashua 88.3.
WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
It's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. On Saturday, a Florida jury convicted Michael Dunn of attempted murder for shooting into a car full of African-American teens playing loud music. But the jury failed to reach a verdict on the most serious charge of first-degree murder in the